King Charles returns to work, Prince Harry and Meghan are going on tour, and Meghan Markle's dear friend distances herself from the royal. I'm Jack Royston, Newsweek's chief royal correspondent, and this is Newsweek's Royal Report. Hello, listeners, and welcome to the show. King Charles's health, on all accounts, appears to have been going from strength to strength since his cancer diagnosis was first announced in February. Now he's going to be returning to public duties. So this was a little bit of positive news that dropped late in the day on Friday. It broke at 6 p.m. UK time, and so that's about 1 p.m. on the East Coast. And it was actually way more dramatic than it sounds, because there was a crazy period, only a short period, early in the morning, when all sorts of rumours were circulating that he was going to abdicate or that he'd hit a sudden decline. Essentially, I think what happened was that there was a report suggesting that some in the corridors of power had been concerned about the king's health, which I'm sure, to be fair, is probably true. Cancer is a concerning diagnosis after all. But the proximity of that story and the revelation that a palace statement of some kind was imminent created a kind of short-lived storm in media circles, with gossip going around that things had taken a turn for the worse. It actually became clear fairly quickly that that was not the case, and well in advance of the statement itself. We were told basically that this was going to be good news, not bad news, for the king. And he's potentially got a busy few months ahead of him. So especially given when you think that he's a 75-year-old man who's still undergoing cancer treatment. He's not actually stopped the treatment. So he's still undergoing treatment. And he's got a busy slate ahead of him. So here are essentially the details. Charles is not yet in remission. So technically he's not, I suppose, completely in the clear. However, his doctors are said to be very happy with his progress. So he's going to start doing some public duties again. Now, he has been doing some duties, including those involving paperwork, but he's also been doing some face-to-face meetings, largely at Buckingham Palace, for example, meeting the Prime Minister or meeting High Commissioners. So what will change is that he will go back to also doing some public visits, starting with one in support of cancer charities, Cancer Research UK and the Macmillan Cancer Trust. So this visit is pitched at encouraging early diagnosis, which is obviously, you know, it's a great cause. And a great way to turn what has no doubt been a difficult experience into something positive. Here's the palace statement. His Majesty the King will shortly return to public-facing duties after a period of treatment and recuperation following his recent cancer diagnosis. To help mark this milestone, the King and Queen will make a joint visit to a cancer treatment centre next Tuesday, that being this Tuesday if you're listening to this episode as it comes out, where they will meet medical specialists and patients. This visit will be the first in a number of external engagements His Majesty will undertake in the weeks ahead. In addition, the King and Queen will host Their Majesties the Emperor and Empress of Japan for a state visit in June at the request of His Majesty's government. As the first anniversary of the coronation approaches, Their Majesties remain deeply grateful for the many kindnesses and good wishes they have received from around the world throughout the joys and challenges of the past year. So, you know, interesting to see a reference to the joys of the past year as well. It's not all been bad news, but clearly, you know, he's looking to get back to where he was before all of this began in 2024. There's obviously a reference in there to the state visit from Japan in June. It's actually shaping up to be a busy month for royal events. There's a decision to be made about whether Charles can do Trooping the Colour, which is the military parade held to mark his official birthday. By tradition, it's always held in June, although in reality he was born in November, Queen Elizabeth II in April, but it's always June nonetheless. Now, I talked about this decision a lot last week, so I don't want to labour the point this week, but things have also kind of changed. So last week it was a doubt whether he would attend at all. But now that he is actively going back to work, it raises the prospect that if he's really feeling up to it, he could actually ride in the parade potentially, which, you know, he did do last year. But it does involve wearing one of those very tall black bearskin hats of the kind that people may have seen on the guards who patrol Buckingham Palace. Now, depending on how the weather falls in June, and it is always difficult to predict in Britain, but it could be very hot, and the soldiers participating in trooping have been known in the past to actually faint, to pass out from the heat, whereupon everybody keeps going with the parade all the same, and somebody comes and helps the soldier away. So some might think that at 75 and while receiving treatment for cancer, it's better not to risk that happening to Charles. Obviously, it would be completely bonkers and unprecedented if he did trooping and something like that happened. I mean, it would be terrible. There is another option, though, which is to focus on the Buckingham Palace balcony appearance that comes at the end. So if Charles were to do the parade, you know, him and William would take part in it on horseback and then would appear on the Buckingham Palace balcony afterwards, where they would watch alongside the rest of the family a fly past by aircraft, jets and helicopters from the Royal Air Force. Now, I personally think that he should just do the balcony. I mean, why risk it? Just imagine if he was overwhelmed in the heat. Imagine if he passed out on his horse. There would be such a reckoning day for whoever let that go ahead, no matter how much he might have been pushing it himself that he wanted to do it. You know, there would be a huge reckoning day for whoever gave him the thumbs up. In addition, there's also, though, a decision to be made about the 80th anniversary of D-Day, which will be a massive event and it will fill all the papers in Britain in early June. There will be wall-to-wall coverage, and I suspect Charles would really want to go and be the kind of royal family's figurehead there. No doubt if he doesn't, it will be William or Camilla. But I could see this being really important to Charles and one that he would regret missing in years to come if he didn't go. Then there's also the summer garden parties. So each summer, the monarch usually throws a whole load, kind of four or five parties in the gardens of Buckingham Palace or up at Balmoral in Scotland. And it's kind of a way to honour the great and good of British society, including, you know, many of the people who do great work for charity each year. Now, it does mean a lot to people from all over the country. In that respect, it also brings people from all over the country into the king's orbit. And in that respect, he is kind of supposed to be shielding a bit. Like, he's obviously probably been shielding quite a lot up until this point. And now this is, by definition, a decision to shield less. But I still wonder whether this might be one of those moments that actually comes with perhaps a slightly higher degree that you get sick, because you don't really want that to happen if you're being treated for cancer. You're considered obviously high risk and you want to limit your exposure to other illnesses. I don't know. I think, to be honest with you, they are outside, so that's in the plus column. But I still wonder whether actually the garden parties are the most likely events to be cut. I think if you were looking back on this situation in 10 years' time, you probably wouldn't mind too much if you cut a bunch of garden parties, but you really would mind if you didn't go to the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and you really would mind as king if you hadn't been there to be the figurehead and leader of the royal family at your birthday parade. So I think those two events come high priority, plus the Japanese state visit is confirmed. It's still probably up for grabs how much involvement Charles will have, but he will host them at Buckingham Palace, I believe. And then there's also the potential of him to go to Ascot in the mix as well. So I wonder whether the Buckingham Palace garden parties might be more likely to be under threat. These decisions, I think, have not actually yet been made. They are still in the process of making them, and no doubt will keep it all under review. You know, Charles is going to be doing more work in the meantime, so they'll see how those jobs go. And if they go well, they might be emboldened to let him do more. Who knows? Maybe he might do all of it. We shall see. Charles and Camilla also released a new picture alongside the announcement to mark the first anniversary of the coronation. And it was taken in the Buckingham Palace garden on the day after their wedding anniversary. Now, it did actually make me chuckle, though, that Charles was a victim of Twitter's menswear sniper less than an hour after he posted this photo online. So I don't know how many listeners know the Dye Workwear account. It's Twitter's premier male fashion journalist, a guy called Derek Guy, in fact. Now, I should preface this by saying that I actually love Derek Guy's account and all of his observations about men's fashion. What he essentially does, though, is he lays there in the long grass waiting for a man in the public eye to show themselves in public wearing a suit badly, particularly a non-bespoke suit, a suit that was ready to wear. Or even worse, I think, in Derek Guy's universe than ready-to-wear is actually made-to-measure. So the difference between made-to-measure and bespoke is made-to-measure is a preset cut of a suit that is then altered in order to try to mold it to the shape of the buyer. Bespoke is handmade from scratch according to measurements and hand-stitched, not machine-stitched, I believe. Now, essentially, so Derek Guy will see a photograph of somebody that's been posted on social media, and if the jacket is too tight, bang, that's it. Derek Guy will strike. He'll point out all the failings and the flaws in it, and is fairly merciless. Too short trousers, bang. Nothing gets past Derek Guy. Anything short, basically, of the standard of Savile Row bespoke, and Derek Guy takes you out from a mile away. Now, Charles, at the tender age of 75, releases a new picture with Camilla to mark the fact he's hit the upward trajectory from a cancer diagnosis, and it took less than an hour for Derek to strike. Bear in mind, Charles is probably the last of the Royal Mail fashion icons, in the sense that, you know, we love talking about Meghan's fashion, Kate's fashion, and Diana's fashion. You know, the female royals really own the world of fashion discussion currently. But back in the day, obviously, male royals were hugely influential in the world of men's fashion. William and Harry kind of don't really try very hard to dress to impress, in my opinion, and so there's just a lot less to say about their outfits. William is very conservative, and, you know, tends to do the whole smart trousers with a shirt and jumper thing. Harry has some, I think his kind of California sunshine outfit of a blue jacket and white trousers looks very elegant. I think he looks very good in it, but neither of them particularly do anything that's outside of the mold. Charles, by contrast, has been praised for his suits dating back decades, and which Derek did actually acknowledge, to be fair to him, and said that throughout his life he has dressed really well. But he did also feel the need to get in there that he feels Charles's clothes don't fit that well anymore, and that it has been suggested that he switched from bespoke to made to measure in the early 2000s. Now, as I said previously, made to measure is probably the type of suit that attracts the most condemnation from Derek Guy. I would also tentatively suggest that the man, i.e. Charles, is known for not throwing his clothes away, basically. He keeps suits for decades. Now, a bespoke suit is only a perfect fit as long as your body shape doesn't change. Like, Charles is 75 and he's being treated for cancer. Like, perhaps his suit doesn't fit because he's understandably lost some weight and didn't want to just go out and spend $5,000 or $10,000 on a new bespoke suit that takes 12 weeks to make while being treated for cancer. So I think give the king a break. But anyway, I digress. That is not the point. So the big return to work was Tuesday for Charles and focused on progress being made in the world of cancer treatment. Now, the king has been working in this field dating back decades, and so too was his mother, the queen. She did a lot of work in this area too. But I could really see that being viewed in a whole new light now that he and Kate have both been diagnosed themselves. I also think it would be great to see Charles and Kate working together on an engagement like this at some point in the future when she's obviously well enough to return to work, which she has said she wants to do at some stage. Said she is planning to return to work, but only once she has had some time to rest and recuperate and get healthy again. She's undergoing chemotherapy herself. She was diagnosed with cancer earlier this year following abdominal surgery. And, you know, they hope that the cancer was all removed in the surgery. But she is having what she described as a preventative course of chemotherapy. So, you know, if they could team up at some point in the future, when Kate does go back to work and do some work for cancer charities, it could become one of those areas that the royals are really known for, in the same way that Queen Elizabeth II showed real leadership around coronavirus. Both in the early days, she did this big kind of very poignant and famous public broadcast in which she quoted a very famous wartime song. And said, you know, we will see our friends again, we will see our families again, we will meet again. Everybody was social distancing, obviously, at the time. We will meet again was a very famous song by Vera Lynn, that kind of summed up the way people felt during the Second World War. So then, obviously, the Queen also got COVID, but then she also stuck to the rules at Prince Philip's funeral, reducing the number of guests and giving him a kind of pared-down funeral in order to show the public that she was going to follow the same rules that they all had to follow. So in the same way that the Queen was kind of really defined her work in her final years through both her direct experiences of COVID, but also the role that she was able to play in showing leadership, I think that both cancer survivors and current cancer patients would really value and appreciate having both Charles and Kate on their side advocating for this cause, and that they could actually win lifelong support for doing that. And it could actually become one of those really kind of big, high-profile projects that the royal family are known for. For Kate, this week was also her and Prince William's 13th wedding anniversary. No doubt a more simple affair than on most years, given everything she's been going through at the moment. But they did release a previously unseen photo from their wedding, taken by Millie Pilkington, who is the same photographer who took the latest picture of Charles and Camilla. So obviously a big vote of confidence in her from both the royal family's most high-ranking couples. Obviously, she has taken many royal portraits going down the years, including photographing George, Charlotte and Louis. So clearly a very safe pair of hands. And of course, she did their wedding pictures back in 2011. Again, William and Kate released the picture on social media and not through picture agencies. So I don't think that old school way of doing things is going to make a comeback as far as the Wales are concerned, as far as Kensington Palace are concerned. I think they are done dealing with picture agencies. Charles and Camilla released their new photo the old-fashioned way. They did do it through the Press Association, which is a major British news agency, but William and Kate didn't. So William and Kate still doing things their own way, and Charles and Camilla not feeling obliged to follow them. Charles and Camilla still perfectly happy and comfortable and willing to follow the old path, while William and Kate forged their own new direction. And on that note, I'm going to take a quick break. Please remember to rate and review The Royal Report on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your favourite shows. When I'm back, Harry and Meghan are going on tour.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Prince Harry is due to return to Britain in May for a series of engagements marking 10 years of the Invictus Games. And after that, Meghan's going to be joining him on a visit to Nigeria. So that means Meghan is skipping Britain, or so it appears. Now, maybe that's not a huge surprise. Obviously, she is not hugely popular in the UK currently. In fact, the centrepiece of this visit is a service of thanksgiving for Invictus at St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, the last time Meghan went there, Meghan and Harry were booed by royalists. That was during Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee. There were cheers as well, but there were certainly boos. And that was during, it was a similar service of thanksgiving, but this time it was for the Queen. Now, by contrast, Meghan will obviously get a very positive welcome in Nigeria. So she may simply be choosing guaranteed good PR over the possibility of another moment of hubris at the hands of monarchists who don't really like her very much. Out of all the possible reasons that could draw Meghan to British soil again, you would think Invictus would be quite high up on the list. It's entirely Harry's project. It's nothing to do with the royals. It's loved across British and American society. And I'm sure the service will draw some big names too. On the political side of things, I think we'll probably see the government represented. Johnny Mercer is the veterans minister. He went to the Invictus Games in Dusseldorf in Germany in September. And Harry had some contact with him in relation to one of his lawsuits. So they clearly have a bit of a relationship. The actor Damian Lewis from Homeland and Band of Brothers will be there. And I'm sure there are many people across British society who would love to have that association with Invictus. Harry and Meghan do poll badly in Britain, but there is still a lot of respect for Harry's military career in general, the fact that he served in Afghanistan, and also specifically for the games themselves, so, because it's just such a universally recognised positive event. The tournament contributes so much to the lives of veterans, many of whom have made really huge sacrifices in serving and come away having lost limbs, for example, but also with huge emotional scars as well. And that's part, I think, of the point of the games, is that it's there to give these ex-service men and women a sense of purpose. It's something to aim for, some goals and a structure. It serves as a kind of catalyst for their rehabilitation. So in preparing for the games, they're making their bodies strong. They're making themselves mentally agile. It's all that stuff that is that helps them with their physical rehabilitation, but also with their mental rehabilitation too. Meghan has generally been a great supporter of Invictus. She's continued to attend the tournaments and also not just the actual games themselves, but the kind of one year to go promotional events too. So why not this one in Britain, especially since it's, you know, it's a whole program marking the 10-year anniversary. So it's a long time until it's going to be the 20-year anniversary. You'd think that she would want to be there. It could genuinely be as simple as the fact that Britain probably holds some pretty difficult memories for her. She obviously didn't enjoy her time working for the monarchy, and she also has had a really hard time with the British press, to put it mildly. I kind of do understand why she might just look at the whole situation and think, well, you didn't exactly, you know, show me lots of love, so why should I show you lots of love? There's also this kind of, there's been a number of times she's tried to create a kind of US versus Britain framing for how it all went wrong in the UK, sometimes in a lighthearted way, sometimes in a more serious way. So, for example, you know, she said at one point that she wasn't ready for the British tabloids because we don't have that in America, which raised some eyebrows, I think, in Britain, where people probably regard Fox News, for example, as being a kind of tabloid news show. It's not in print, obviously, but it's certainly, you know, a very different tone. The way I see it, in America, American TV is the equivalent of the British press, and the British TV is the equivalent of the American press, which can be confusing to people, but effectively Fox News is the equivalent to America of the Daily Mail and the Sun in Britain, is my view of it. There's also been, yeah, so you've got, on the one hand, you've got that comment about the press, but there's been other points as well. She suggested she had an awkward interaction with William because she's a hugger, and that it's unsettling for some British people because British people aren't huggers, which I think came as a surprise to some British people who are. And then there was the Netflix curtsy, when she said her first curtsy to the Queen, she did it wrongly because as an American, she thought it would be done like medieval times dinner and tournament. So that, I think, she intended to be lighthearted, but it offended a lot of people. So this ongoing framing may be a product of genuine surprise at finding Britain to be different to her expectations, but I do also think there might be a degree of what I think some people call emotional leakage as well, in the parlance of our times, as in, I just don't think that she likes Britain very much, and sometimes that comes across even when she didn't really intend it to. Also, though, you know, on a more kind of banal, or not banal, but a more emotional front, going away for long periods of time is difficult as a parent because you have to leave your kids behind, presumably. It's not impossible, I suppose, that they could take Archie and Lee with them, but they may not want to for the next reason that I was going to discuss, which is that Harry and Meghan don't have guaranteed police protection in Britain anymore. They may simply feel that the country isn't safe for the whole family. Now, personally, I do think that would be a little over the top. They are not the only people in Britain who might be targets for you know, even the exact same kind of far-right mob who have racist attitudes towards Meghan. You know, if you take a politician, for example, like Diane Abbott, the first Black British MP, served the Labour Party for most of her career, although she has recently had the whip removed. She's viscerally hated by the far right, largely because of the color of her skin. No doubt some would present other reasons, but clearly skin color is a massive factor. And she had to turn up to Parliament week in and week out. Now, she was at risk during that time, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's impossible to survive living in Britain. You know, risk has to be managed, but it's not certainty. And, you know, if you're talking about a short visit to Britain and you have private security anyway, I personally don't see any reason why that could not be conducted perfectly safely. But there we go. That's just my opinion. And that's a side point. Inevitably, there will be questions about whether Harry and William will meet up and whether they will patch up their differences. I think that's very unlikely. I'd like to see Harry meet Charles. I think that would be nice to see. I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's their relationship, it's their lives. Who am I to say what they should do? But I think it would be nice to see if it happened. Obviously, it doesn't look like Harry is going to lose his father anytime soon with Charles going back to work. So I don't think there's like a time pressure for them to, you know, forcing them to meet up if it doesn't work out. But I also think they're kind of in the process of a long, slow journey back to trust, which I think has begun, but maybe has not progressed as far as it needs to. You know, just because something started, just because peace has kind of broken out, it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't more work to do. I think there's probably quite a lot more work to do. We don't yet have a full itinerary for Harry's visit, but it sounds like there's going to be a program of events, so multiple engagements. So hopefully that means Harry's going to be in Britain for a little longer this time and stands a good chance of seeing Charles. Remember that he did actually come to Britain relatively recently, back in February, pretty much as soon as Charles announced that he had been diagnosed with cancer, Harry jumped on a plane and came to the UK. He caught the king just as Charles was about to head up to Sandringham for some time away from Britain. They had a brief meeting and parted ways. It looks like Harry potentially may not have been invited up to Sandringham, or if he was, he didn't feel he could go. Either way, he was back on board a flight to America fairly rapidly, and of course didn't see his brother. So we'll see how it all goes this time around. But hopefully with slightly longer to plan, they'll have managed to book in a slightly longer period of time, and maybe with a little less pressure, maybe with a slightly more relaxed context, a nice long lunch or something like that, where they can actually properly kind of work things out and talk to each other on a slightly deeper level. Now, Harry's attendance was confirmed by the Invictus Games Foundation, which said it will celebrate 10 years of changing lives and saving lives with a service of thanksgiving at St. Paul's Cathedral on May 8th. We will be joined by our patron, Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex, actor Damian Lewis, and members of the worldwide Invictus community to mark the occasion. Once Harry's done in Britain, it's on to Nigeria, of course, with Meghan joining him at that point. This visit to Nigeria also has an Invictus focus. Nigeria joined the Invictus family in 2022, but competed for the first time in 2023. Now they've invited Harry and Meghan to visit as a means of strengthening that bond. Harry and Meghan accepted the invitation. It's not hard to see why. After all, Meghan made much of the fact that she discovered that she has Nigerian ancestry following a DNA test. She discussed all this on Archetypes, her podcast, back in 2022. So that all makes sense as a framing for Harry and Meghan. The other interesting thing, though, is that Nigeria's defence forces have made no secret of the fact they would like to host the Games. There was a press statement released suggesting that the defence headquarters has expressed its honour and delight for the acceptance of the Duke of Sussex, His Royal Highness Prince Harry, and his wife, the Duchess of Sussex Meghan, to visit Nigeria in May 2024. During their stay in the country, it says, they'll be meeting service members and be treated to some cultural activities. The visit, the statement says, is to consolidate Nigeria's stronghold at the Games and the possibility of hosting the event in later years. It says that the Ministry of Defence, who was in Germany at last year's event, has accepted the idea of hosting the Games if granted to Nigeria. So, you know, a big show of affection towards the tournament. Now, interestingly, Britain also reportedly wants to host Invictus again too. So it almost kind of feels like maybe both countries are love bombing Harry to try and get the nod of approval to host the Games. Which must feel great for Harry if so, especially after everything he's been through in terms of Britain, the British public falling so hard out of love with him. it must feel fantastic to be in demand and kind of a relief as well. You know, 2023 got really negative. And also, you know, some of the open royal warfare must have been fairly traumatic for both sides. Plenty was Harry and Meghan effectively declaring war on the monarchy and the royals in public. I suspect, though, that after the dust settled on all of that and with a lot of bridges burned, the enduring power of Invictus will have shown Harry what really matters and what he wants his legacy to be. There is no real legacy in attacking his family. Invictus is his legacy, and it creates a basis on which people will still love and respect him, even if they think he was wrong to pile on the royals. You have to have something that you're offering that people actually want, and Invictus is that, and that's why he's still getting love, including in Britain, from the Conservative Party, many of whose supporters will probably hate him. But they're still showing him love because they want Invictus, because they respect Invictus and they love Invictus. And there is a lesson there. You have to have something that people actively want. And on that note, I'm going to take one more quick break. But before I do, a reminder to follow me on X, formerly Twitter. I'm at @Jack_Royston. You will find all my latest stories for Newsweek. And when I'm back, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau distances herself from Meghan.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Sophie Gregoire Trudeau was a guest on Meghan Markle's Archetypes podcast, and Meghan was emphatic about how close they were and how well they got on, saying that they laughed together like schoolgirls, they spent a day by the pool, their children played together, she talked about the cost of the floats that she bought for the pool, all of this kind of thing. And to all intents and purposes, they do seem to have had a relationship and a reasonably close one. So Sophie is the former First Lady-ish of Canada. Much like in Britain, they don't actually formally have the title First Lady. So she doesn't have an official title, but she's married to and separated from Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. But going back to a past Canadian Arts and Fashion Awards in Toronto some years previously, there is a photo of Sophie kissing Meghan on the cheek. So clearly there was some warmth between them. And of course, Sophie agreed to do Archetypes. So it is therefore understandable that a journalist from the Times wanted to ask Sophie during an interview about her seemingly very close ties to Meghan. The only slight problem is that Sophie did not seem to want to play ball. So the journalist was Louise Callahan. She is a award-winning journalist for the Times newspaper, Rupert Murdoch-owned broadsheet and newspaper of record in Britain. And she wrote in her story, when I bring up Meghan Markle, who did an interview with Gregoire Trudeau on her podcast, when she gushed about a day spent hanging out at the pool with her and her children, where they got giddy like absolute schoolgirls, she does not gush back. I know her, she says, before adding that they haven't spent much time together and telling me how terrible she feels for Kate Middleton after her cancer diagnosis. My heart just sunk when I saw what was happening. So it's quite interesting, I think, that Sophie made the connection to Kate. So she was asked, you know, tell me about your relationship with Meghan or whatever, invited to kind of gush and say how great it was to hang out and all the rest of it. And she immediately pivoted to Kate. So that does kind of suggest that she had the whole debacle at the forefront of the debacle with Kate was obviously said on social media. People thought she was missing or said she was missing, commented on her absence from public life. And basically, the theories to explain this absence escalated and escalated and escalated. They became more and more grotesque. And eventually, Kate was bounced into giving this update to say that she had been diagnosed with cancer, at which point some people felt very ashamed and some people continued to spread theories and speculation. Now, a big driving force behind that whole saga were some members, no doubt not all, but some members of Harry and Meghan's Sussex Squad fan base. So, I mean, it's totally possible that Sophie may have felt Megan's treatment of their archetypes in interview was a little bit sickety-sweet. If it was written down, you would say it was purple prose. You know, she didn't hold back. It was a very more is more presentation. You know, there was much that was great, I think, to the interview. I could say that Megan maybe could have dialed it down about 20% instead of conveyed how close they were. I suppose you never want to be too full on when it comes to kind of milking a contact. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm sure name dropping culture in California is also much more kind of open than Britain. We're all a bit stuffy and reserved and feel the need to kind of pretend that we're not name dropping or not, you know, showing proximity to somebody famous when really we probably are. Elegant and seamless is probably the best way to show your proximity to someone famous, though. And too obvious is a little crass, but I don't personally think that's what's going on here. I think Sophie probably has genuine affection for Meghan, but is just really worried about what might happen if she were perceived to be Team Meghan at a point when some Meghan and Harry fans were the ones driving all of this speculation about Kate, that is, and including really some of the most offensive and unsettling theories. Sophie and Meghan, I mean, the podcast was actually about how difficult it is to be a mother in the public eye. And a woman in the public eye. And that obviously applies to Kate as much as it does to both of them. And clearly there's a huge amount of sympathy for Kate. You know, as soon as the cancer diagnosis was revealed, the tide completely turned back the other way. I think perhaps the lesson here for celebrities and politicians everywhere is to beware your own fans, because their actions will reflect on you, and not just publicly, but potentially privately among your celebrity peers, or if you're in politics, among, you know, other politicians and the general political world. And if you let them, your fans, online, rampage out of control, undermining moral principles that you hold dear, such as respect for privacy or respect for other people's mental health and emotional well-being, or, you know, not just other people, but specifically here, another woman in the public eye, you know, that could reflect on you. So assuming that is what's happening, what does Meghan do? She has actually in the past gone further than William and Kate in saying to Oprah that, you know, just because someone loves Kate, it doesn't mean they have to hate Meghan. And just because someone loves Meghan, it doesn't mean they have to hate Kate. But that was then, and this is now, and nobody's really paid any attention to it. So maybe it's worth considering saying a little more and trying to, I guess, rein in some of the conspiracy theories. I mean, it's actually, in a sense, fine to just say, especially if you wind back to the time when the Mother's Day photo came out. Obviously, Kate did Photoshop this family picture. It bore the hallmarks of manipulation, and photo agencies issued kill notices. And in that moment, it was certainly fine to criticize and to say that that shouldn't have happened. And, you know, there is a space where criticism and accountability is legitimate, but it's about knowing where the line is. And Harry and Meghan have had so many conspiracy theories about them, their marriage supposedly being on the point of collapse, you know, the body language between them on visits. They've had so much of it, and some of it so hostile and negative, and obviously have complained bitterly about it, quite reasonably. You know, I don't say bitterly to suggest that they shouldn't have done. But, you know, Meghan said it was almost unsurvivable. And yet here, while Kate's going through cancer and a really difficult abdominal surgery, her fans, Meghan's fans and Harry's fans, are doing the same thing to Kate that was done to Meghan, which Meghan said was almost unsurvivable. And it just feels a little bit like maybe an intervention might help actually protect Meghan from the reputational fallout of that behavior, which she can't control, you know, except through a public intervention. You know, that is the only means of control. Just a thought, anyway, to end this episode. And that's it for this week's episode of The Royal Report. Be sure to join me every week when I visit the latest royal headlines, embark on some royal deep dives, and riff on all things royal. Until next time, I'm Jack Royston. Thanks for listening, everyone, and a curtsy to you all.